Mr. Chair,
the regular meeting of September 9th.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Who's administering the Zoom today for us?
Robert.
Robert, I was just going to make a request. I know it's been a while since we've done this, but to make...
Uh-oh.
We just lost him.
I did not do...
Robert?
There's some interference.
Remind me not to complain about Zoom.
Not to the administrator.
There's some interference on someone's connection. So maybe we should just mute until.
How's mine? Is it coming in clear?
Yeah, we can hear you, Bob.
All right. Hey, who's calling in on the phone line?
This is Doug Ward.
Okay, Doug, thanks.
Morning, Doug.
You might have to put your phone on mute, Doug. I'm not sure if that's causing the interference or not.
Yeah, I'll do that.
He's got to be able to answer for roll call, so.
Yeah, so let's, this is the regular meeting of September 9th, so Sharon, would you please call the roll?
I will, and Mr. Chair, I'll note for the record that Mr. Prysanka has advised that he will be calling in a few minutes late, and that Mr. Amelon and Mr. Lynn will not be present for the meeting. Moving on from that, Siebertson.
Present.
Ward.
Present.
Bynum.
Here.
Skillings.
Here.
Coos. Audison. Hagerman.
Here. Sharon Prysanka is now on if you'd like to call his name.
Prysanka, are you available?
I see he's got video and no audio.
Yes, I do. I'm going to mark you present, Mr. Prysanka. I don't know if you can hear me. Is there anyone else on the line that would like to introduce themselves? No response, Mr. Chair?
We have Bynum back on too, Sharon.
Mr. Bynum?
Here.
Yep, I had him marked.
Okay.
Thank you. Roll is done, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Jeremy, before we get into it, you had a question early on.
Mr. Chair, point of privilege. I would request that this is our first time back to Zoom in a while, that members that aren't speaking, that we would mute our mics. It creates a lot of feedback for the meeting and presenters.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Communications and lay on the table. I have a memo from Sharon in regards to agenda minutes and the fact that Joy Mariner will be joining us at 10 o'clock today. So with that, we'll move on to disclosures of conflicts of interest. We have any disclosures of conflict of interest at this time? Seeing and hearing none, we'll move on to the approval of agenda. And with that, I'd like to have a motion to amend the agenda to add to new business 7K to appoint Secretary Treasurer in Carl's absence. And it would be nice if it was a voting member in Ketchikan, which would be, I think, Jeremy or somebody because of the ability to come in and sign documents at that particular time. So with that, do I have a motion to add item 7K to the agenda?
Mr. Chair.
Page.
Yes.
Move to add item 7K, the addition of the finance position to the agenda. That's it.
Second.
It has been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? And as you can see, the motion. Okay, that was an executive. That's a motion. Okay, so with that and hearing no discussion, Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Einem?
Yes.
Sievertson?
Yes.
Karen, I'm sorry, I can barely hear you. I'm not sure if you're calling my name or not.
Skillings?
Yes.
Prysunka?
Yes.
Thank you.
Amendment passes. I'd like to have a motion to approve the agenda as amended.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I also need to call on Mr. Hagerman in Bob Lynn's absence.
All right.
For Petersburg. Hagerman, for the agenda motion. Thank you.
Yes, on the agenda motion.
Thank you.
All right, the amendment passes. I'd like to have a motion to approve the agenda as presented.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Move to approve the agenda as amended.
So Sharon Carl make the motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
It has been seconded. Any discussion? Hearing and seeing none, Sharon, would you please call the roll on approval of the agenda?
I will. Prysunka?
Yes.
Bynum?
Yes.
Sievertson?
Yes.
Skillings?
Yes.
Hagerman?
Yes.
Thank you
very much. Brings us on to item 3, persons to be heard. Is there anybody wishing to speak to the SEPA board of directors at this time? Is there anybody online that wishes to speak? And at this time, if there is anybody online, would you please declare and introduce yourself? Hearing and seeing none, we'll move on to item 4, review and approval of the minutes, May 13th, 2021. We need a motion to amend the minutes of May 13th, 2021 to change the third sentence and hold business item 6B regarding the wholesale power rate from, we advise the agency could then consider a 0.25% increase to, and advise that the agency could then consider the 0.25 per kilowatt increase. So it's not a percent, it's changed to cent. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make that motion. Should I repeat it?
No, that's all right.
Okay.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. And thank you for your diligence in reading through those minutes and finding errors such as that. Is there any discussion? Hearing and seeing none, Sharon, would you vote on the amendment for the minutes?
Will Hagerman?
Yes.
Prysunka? Prysunka?
Yes.
Bynum?
Yes.
Sievertson?
Yes.
Skillings.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So with that, would I have a motion to approve the minutes as amended?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would move to approve the minutes as amended for the May 13th, 2021 meeting.
Thank you, Bart. Do I have a second?
I'll second that.
Thank you. So it has been moved and seconded to approve the minutes of May 13th. Any discussion? Hearing and seeing none. Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Skillings?
Yes.
Hagerman?
Yes.
Prysunka?
Yes.
Bynum?
Yes.
Sievertson.
Yes. Thank you much for that. Moves us on to item 5, the financial reports. 5A is a CEO financial memo. Trey, would you please run us through the presentation.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, everyone. Glad to see everybody. Sorry we can't meet in person, but this is the second best. So anyway, moving along, the just I'll read a few things into the record. The in my memo, I cover a number of topics, and then they're detailed in your financial packet. But SEPA's financial position is currently stable. You know, our reservoirs are at maximum capacity, which should help, you know, our future sales. Unfortunately, some folks don't realize that when we have an abundant amount of rain, actually SEPA sales can go down, especially with Ketchikan and somewhat with Petersburg, because they tend to run their own assets, their legacy assets, if you will, prior to buying from SEPA. So there's kind of that fine balance in there. But, you know, right now, you know, things look as good as they could possibly go be at this time of year as far as, you know, potential for revenue downstream here. With regard to revenue and expenses, you know, we're really pretty much right on budget with our revenue. And operating expense is about $1 million below budget in expenditures. And that's mostly due to some allocations with transmission line overhead maintenance. And those will roll in a little bit over the next month or two as those invoices are processed. And, you know, another area that we were under is, you know, we're still recruiting for a new position. And so we do have some vacancy factor also impacting that. With regard to renewal and replacement projects, you'll see in under the disbursement list as we get a little bit deeper into the financial packet, we've been spending some money over this last quarter, if you will, and you know, right now we're at about $8 million versus our total budget of about 17.5. We've got a number of invoices which we've detailed in a separate memo. With regard to the Stikine submarine cable replacement fund project. And that's a nice segue into the next part. You know, we did complete the bond issuance through the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank for the submarine cable replacement. And, you know, we've also detailed that for you as well. All in true interest costs was 2.55%, which was really fantastic. And so I was very pleased with that. And I'll explain some of the nuances behind that and the premiums we get and how that comes across in print. But at the end of the day, 2.55%, and that includes issuance costs as well. So we still do have our submarine cable capital funding request out. Which is has been explained to the board before, and right now things are a bit in disarray in Juneau, and I've been in contact with our lobbyists there and other folks discussing this and trying to keep it at the forefront. But right now they're pretty hung up on the dividend and what that's going to be, and you know, and right now they can't even come to terms on, you know, what the anticipated revenue for the state is. So lots more to talk about that a little bit later. And grants, those are reported quarterly, so no real change there. But we have been using some of that outstanding total for LIDAR and marine hydrokinetic site investigation. And we'll also get into that a little bit later. And one final thought, at least on my financial cover, is, you know, we do have the audit today that was mentioned earlier by the chair. And I'm always very pleased. We've always had clean audits. And I think that's, I mean, that's just outstanding. That's one of our main things that we focus on every year and is a key component in our success metrics. And anyway, Joy Mariner will be calling in approximately about 10 o'clock today to update the board there on that. And so I'll pause there, Mr. Chair, and let you guys get a motion on the table on page 9 there.
Thank you, Trey. So there is a motion before you. It's projected upon the screen. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move to accept year-to-date financial statements through July 2021 and disbursements for May, June, and July 2021 totaling $7,250,737.35 as presented.
Do I have a second?
I'll second that.
Thank you. So with that, do you want to go into the details of the disbursements prior to voting on it?
I'll run through the whole financial packet, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, and that'll be part of it toward the end of the packet.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. So I'll direct your attention to page 10 of your packet. And this is just our typical megawatt sales year to year comparison. And for the most part, you can see that our August sales are lower than, I'll say, average. And that's reflective of the nuance to having a lot of hydro resources that I explained a little bit earlier. But for the most part, we're pretty much right on average compared to the previous 10 years. So,
Mr. Chair,
no big surprises there.
Yes, Jeremy.
I just wanted to have a question for Mr. Atkinson. As previously stated in the past, sir, I do not believe that these year-to-date sales include any kind of true-up values and are not included in the value. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. These are just sales.
Correct. Okay.
Yeah, because we don't know those till the end of the year after you do all the calculations for spill.
Sure.
Thank you. Go ahead, Trey.
Sure. So on the next page, on page 11, you can just see on the year-to-date power sales, you can see that Ketchikan's are actually lower. Petersburg are actually a little bit higher. And Wrangell are pretty spot on because they don't have any of their own generation resources. So just point out a couple details there. And if you turn to page number 13, you can see that our cumulative power sales are pretty much spot on to our budget curve. So any questions yet? Okay. Moving on.
So Trey, in regards to the sales and stuff that we delivered all that was asked for. I know that we were doing some work at Swan and one turbine or part of that was down for a little while. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we always have, you know, our annual maintenance windows where we have some outages, and then any of the other work that that we can do and still make full deliveries. When loads are really low, we can make full deliveries out of just one of the plants too. So, yeah, we've been able to make deliveries outside of our normal maintenance.
Thank you.
Moving on to page 14, we made this up just at the last minute because these sales numbers and figures come in right at the end of the month there, and that's kind of right before this. So we were able to pull this updated fund allocation chart together. And I think most of all, you're going to see a large change in this in our next meeting as the funds from the construction dedicated fund for the submarine cable get reimbursed into where they were initially paid for a portion of that. And then we have quite a significant number of large invoices that will hit here in the next 30 days. So this will all be kind of repositioned, but it shows you where we're currently at year to day. And also I'll note that there's a footnote there that, you know, we've made three payments into the dedicated R&R fund, and we have one remaining one. As you recall, we're trying to make those payments on a quarterly basis, whereas we used to put the full amount in right at the beginning of the fiscal year. So we may put them in at variable times, but on the most part, we try to put them in on a quarterly basis just to kind of levelize that out so you don't get a huge hit right in the beginning that affects your cash flow.
So, Trey, a while back, the board changed the amount of funds that were held in the R&R, I think it was. We were at about $10 million and we reduced it to $8 million. Is that correct?
That was the self-insured risk fund.
Self-insured risk fund, okay.
Yeah, and that $2 million that was shaved off the top got reallocated into the new generation fund.
So as we look at what the cost was in regards to the cable replacement, and again, what we're doing in regards to upgrades and the potential risk, is that number still viable, or should there be an increase to that? Because I know costs have gone up considerably for materials and the delay of projects and other things like that. So have you guys discussed that internally?
So great question. Thank you. That question will be answered in full when we update the 4R plan, which we're in the process of doing right now. But in just to kind of give you a feel for that a little bit, first of all, the self-insured risk fund is essentially set up with a minimum balance for what we think our highest risk scenario is. And so in the past, it's been actually our insurance deductible, which tended to be a little bit higher than the actual replacement of a single failed submarine cable. Obviously, from this most recent construction effort to replace a cable, we've updated those costs with true numbers. Now, what we'll do during the 4R plan is we'll review those reserves and we'll make a recommendation to the board. So one thing that could impact the self-insured risk fund is, you know, we previously discussed with the board the potential for purchasing a spare submarine cable that would handle our longest distance crossing. And that does a couple of things. It allows you to run all your other cables to failure and get maximum life and value out of your existing cables. But what that also does is it would essentially lower the risk profile for the self-insured risk fund so that, you know, we may not need to plug in a whole bunch of extra money into that account. But if we were not to purchase the spare cable, then I anticipate that we'll be making a recommendation for an increase in that.
So in regard to our longest run, what would the expected cost of purchasing a cable to put into storage be?
So we've actually reached out to Sumitomo and requested them to provide us a quote on that. And so we're awaiting for them to, they have to do a little bit more research because there's some depth issues on our deepest crossing, which is about 1200 feet. And the cable that they designed for this most recent was for 700 feet. So they've got a few things they've got to check up on to get firm numbers. And to kind of put it in context, the cable, just the cable itself was about $3.5 million for this latest endeavor. So we'll have to see. Obviously, copper prices have gone up since then, and we'll need a little bit longer length of cable as well. So it could be in the $4 to $4.5 million, maybe. I'm just taking a wild rough order of magnitude estimate there.
So Trey, that would that have to be st- stored undercover, or would it be, it would come in one of those large metal containers that would be stored outside?
So what we're talking with Sumitomo with right now is to essentially ship it in a pan that fits on the carousel that we showed on the video, that you deploy the cable off of. It'd build a pan specifically for that, which would fit on the ITB barge or a similar barge on a carousel. And then the internal portion, think of it like a donut looking down on top. You know, that has a certain capacity to hopefully carry all of the old cable. So they can bring the old cable onto the boat, put it into the pan, and then they can lay the new cable. Thanks, Robert. That's a great picture there. You can see where the ladder goes in. That's where the old cable would typically go. And so that whole thing would likely be stored in Wrangell. And, you know, these are robust cables designed to be in very harsh conditions, but we would cover it just to protect the serving that's on the outside of the cable from being UV damaged.
So is the infrastructure there to, I guess, unload and move this thing into a place of where it needs to be stored?
So I think that there's a couple of options there, and we have to get the total weight on what it would be. So there's a possibility, just reviewing kind of how it worked last time, it got shipped from Japan, it landed in Canada and got transferred. I could see it being shipped there. And then when it gets transferred onto a barge there, you actually put the specific piece of equipment that a crane or of the specific capacity to move it, you just put it right on the barge with it. And then you carried it up with the barge, you offload it, move it to wherever you want. You put the crane back on the barge and it goes back to its home port. That's one scenario that would be the case. It's heavy. You know, the last cable, just the new cable itself was, I think, about 750,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Approximately. So the new cable is going to be longer. So you might be looking at 1,000,000 pounds. And then, of course, once you, you load up the internal part, it gets heavier. But anyway, so that's kind of what we're thinking. And I anticipate, Mr. Chair, that we'll bring something forward to the board at the, in our December meeting with some firm numbers and hopefully an action item there for the board.
Thank you. That's more than enough information.
Okay. Any other questions on that particular topic from anybody? Okay. So that takes us to our bond summary on page 15. And there was just a lot of information here, and I wanted to make sure the board was fully aware of, you know, what happened, where we're at. And so it might get a little complicated. Bonds are kind of funky. But in short, you know, we sold 11.33 million in electric revenue bonds, and they're called the Series 2021. So when you see that in our reports from now, you'll know specifically what we're talking about. Our intent with the bond was to get bond proceeds of 13.37 million. And the reason why we sold 11.33 is we get a premium on a portion of those bonds of 2.926 million. And then, so if you add those together, then you come up with 13.37. So it's a little bit odd, but that's just how they do pricing on bonds. And I've already mentioned, the favorable 2.55% all-in cost, which was pretty good, which was fantastic, actually. And so I guess what I'll do real quick is I'll call your attention to a spreadsheet that I'm going to have Robert pull up right now. It might take him just a second here. And we included one quick spreadsheet for reference for the board on page 18 of your board packet, but we've added an extra column there just so So I could, to help explain one of the nuances for you. So we'll get to that in just a second. And really what I want to illustrate here is if you go to your furthest right column, and that essentially shows what our total bond payment has been historically over the past few years. And you can see that we're essentially migrating from maybe 14.5 million to about 2.25 million. And this will kind of blend into some of our later discussions that we're going to have on that we have a discussion item open for talking about rate increases. So you can see just in additional debt service, it's about 780,000, depending on which years you want to compare year over year. The first year is a little bit different just because you start. We only pay interest, twice a year, and the principal payment doesn't come in until a little bit later. So that one anomaly that Robert's highlighted there, the more standard payment's going to be the one right below it. So happy to answer any questions on that. I think it's fairly straightforward. You can see all of our different series. You can see series 2015 and 19 and 2021. And hopefully that's helpful for folks just to kind of understand SEPA's debt and where we're at and how that all plays off. You can see some of it rolls off the books, I think, in about 2034, 2035, which is, you can see it reduces there. And, you know, that's probably good timing when we set up these bonds. I tried to set it up so we'd have a reduction possibly around the same time that we might be developing a new project. And so that the timing there would be pretty good, or additional, large capex or however. So.
Trey, I do just want to point out that first column, it says series 2015. That's actually series 2000.
Oh, yeah, it's 2009, right?
Just noticed that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's two there. That should be 2009. Excuse me.
Duly noted.
Okay.
Trey, in regards to our bonds, I know that when we originally took over the projects and we had bonds to do that, it was tied directly to the power sales agreement. And those power sales agreements are still in place. And as we take on new debt, such as what we're doing here, they still, the collateral, is still a portion of that is the power sales agreement and the, agreements with the three communities that we take SEPA's power first before we take any other. Is that a correct statement?
When they're evaluating bonds, they look at your revenue and how you're obtaining that and the commitments from your PSA or power sales agreement. That would be a way to characterize that as bond.
Thank you, Trey. And I know that that always comes under scrutiny anytime there is an outside organization that wishes to develop a project and potentially sell into either one of the communities or to SEPA itself. So I just want to make sure that it's clear that we still are abiding by the rules of the power sales agreement in order to fund our projects and future projects.
Correct.
Thank you.
So if there's no further questions on bonds and where we're at with that, then I've already talked about the grant summary on page 19, so nothing really to add there. And that gets us into our detailed financials, which I covered the highlights in my cover, so I won't go into detail, but happy to answer any questions on the actual financials that folks may have.
I got one more question for you on the bond that we received from the bond bank. There is, do they still pay the fees for advertising and going out and getting that money, the state?
So they pay a portion of that. It's actually, have to look. Might even be on one of those forms that we provided, one of the pages behind the bond memo. Let me look real quick.
So that came about years ago when we talked to the Alaska Bond Bank and found out that we were eligible. And one of the nice things about utilizing them is they do pay some of the costs associated with acquiring a bond.
That's correct.
And I think I just want to let the new members know that process, it's fairly new, really, when you think about it, but
they contributed $25,000 towards the cost of issuance. Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, that was their portion.
If you, Robert, if you roll to page 16, I can point it out on that. So right there, cost of issuance, the bond bank COI is a little bit further. And so it's also stated right below, you're real close there, Robert, right there. So it shows up twice there, but definitely that portion was paid by the bond bank. And to more to the chair's, comment there, a few years back, we actually actively pursued getting access to the bond bank and through the legislature, we had to get them to pass that. To make us eligible. And one of the benefits of that is that your overall issuance costs compared to going out into the open market, which SEPA has the capability to do, the issuance costs are substantially lower, and it's lowered our cost of money, if you will. So it's been a very, very beneficial move for the agency.
Yeah, and we also avoid the financial advisory costs. I think some of the rating agency costs and, some of the exceedingly expensive, council costs for issuance. So I think it's been a really great benefit to the agency.
And it's a pretty streamlined process too, comparatively to some other folks, like the board may recall, we looked at really hard at RUS and we're in a parallel path there. Very complicated process, with a lot of, burdensome reporting and things like that. So the bond bank's been just excellent to work with.
Thank
you.
No, that's good.
So were there any questions on the financials that anybody had specifically that they'd like me to address?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I had a question for Mr. Atkinson. Trey, as I'd mentioned before, I looked through our financial statements here, and as I alluded to on page 10, that I don't see any projections in our financial statements with regard to the Whitman true-up. Now, that accounts for about 5% of our budget last year, and it will account for about 5% of our budget this year as far as a revenue stream. And I just don't see it reflected anywhere in our financials.
Well, because we don't budget for it because we don't have any idea what that's going to be. We don't control how KPU runs their units. We don't control how much spill there's going to be. There's just a lot of elements there that we don't forecast.
No, I understand that. Obviously, you can't forecast what's going to happen next year, but we're sitting here currently in August of this year, and we know that there is a somewhat of a projection of what that's going to look like on previous history. And also where we currently sit today. Like I said, that's going to be 5% of our budget of revenue, and we don't have any reflection of that in our budget here. So unless if we just get to the end of the year and it's money that's going to come into the reserve and then we don't include it on
our financial statements and or talk about it, it's not something that we show as a revenue stream. And it's actually a revenue stream because it's display sales.
So first of all, the financials documents that we're going over are completed financials for July. There's no speculation of these numbers. These are the numbers. And to say that we're going to receive some payment, I think these are essentially what we would call, you know, after they're approved, to close the books on that particular month, year to date. So you're right. They're not in our budget, and therefore they're not reflected in here to begin with. Because, you know, if you did, then you'd have a section there where you were budgeting for something. And frankly, it would be showing zero because we haven't collected any funds. So it really doesn't happen until the true up occurs. We monitor it all year, but it does not occur until the end of the year. So we're not getting any revenue in these months at all.
If I might, I was from a budget perspective, what we budget for KPU sales, it's just really included in that budget figure. We don't know if it's going to be firm power sales or true up. We just project how much we think the revenue will be for Ketchikan. And then otherwise, yeah, the true up according to the agreement is calculated as of December 31st. So there's really nothing to record here yet.
And Mr. Chair, do you mind if I jump in here for 1 second?
Go ahead, Robert.
So also on that note is, you know, at the beginning of the year, when we do the operations plan, we predict what each municipality is going to consume and what we as an agency could produce. So that becomes partly our operations plan and then ties into our budget. Every year we determine what we need to spend in R&R costs, but we don't go, you know, this year, 2.5 million. Actually this year, what, 17 million? Typically under 2.5. So our 4R plan is what is our long-term type budgetary item. And so we look out there quite a ways. And so as Kay and Trey have been mentioning, we don't budget for income or revenues that we can't control or predict. But our long-term goal and plan is such that we budget in that manner. And then every year, our revenues are based on what we actually get. So budget estimate, revenues actual. Bonds and all that stuff are based on actual, not what you think you might get. So I hope that helps clear it up a little bit.
So, Kay, go ahead.
I'm only pointing out the fact that we have about 5% of our revenue stream that we can anticipate and or expect. And we don't even, it's not mentioned. That's all I'm trying to say is that there's no footnote to it. Kay did allude to the fact that there is a projection of what they believe sales should be. And we can see that on budget, on the item page 13, that there's a monthly cumulative budget projection. We can see that we show that there's a projection and we make comments like we are on budget or we are on projection. My point was, is that we just don't have any kind of footnote and or demonstration that that's actually, that the Whitman True-Up is included in this. And like I said, it is a significant component of our funding, by the time we get to the end of the year, at least for this year. And it was for last year. And when we look at last year projection numbers, like I'd said in the past on page 10, there is no reflection of those display sales in those numbers. So, just an observation and, a question.
Well,
we're looking at total sales and we don't differentiate whether it's a true up or not. My question to Kay is, in the audit system, is that noted anywhere? Just out of question that it's
It shows up under income. It's just that it's not recorded until December 31st.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. So thank you for that, Jeremy.
Mr. Chair, could I just comment? I guess I'm a little concerned that there's, I just want to be plain about this. I mean, these financials are presented to the board. These are actual financials. And we're about to hear from our auditor that, you know, we've passed the audit just fine, whether or not particular income, which I think has historically been treated as additional or not, you know, we can't really count on it at any particular moment, is reflected in these financials. But there's nothing about the financials themselves that are untoward or don't reflect reality. So, and I'm not sure that's what you're saying, Jeremy, but I just want to be clear that these are accurate financials. The payment from Whitman is speculative because, you know, we had a drought a couple of years ago. Was there any payment there made for Whitman? I mean, it's just, we don't know. And I just feel like we just need to be clear about what's being presented.
Thank you. All right, Trey, go ahead and continue.
Okay. Just drawing your attention now to page 27. And all I wanted to do here was just highlight down at the bottom there, Robert. If you go down first column there, you can see the transmission overhead lines expense. You can see the big difference there year to budget. So when I mentioned that there that we were under on expense significantly, that's where a huge chunk of that is. And those invoices will be processed through the system here over the next 30 days. So, all right.
Thank you.
That's any other questions on the financials before I move on to the
any other questions? Summary?
Okay, so that takes us to the R&R summary on page 30. And there's just a quick summary there for a quick shot for the board to see where we're at year to date on expenditures versus budget. And some of the prior year expenditures, which some projects span multiple years, and the overall budget. And it's reflective of some of my earlier comments on my cover letter. And like I said earlier, then these expenditures, we disbursements were over 7 million in this last, since our last meeting. And we expect that there's going to be another significant chunk that is going to come out of that as we pay off the Sumitomo invoices. That's going to be the biggest hit. So not much else to add to that. That takes us to page 31. And this is the submarine cable funding summary page. And I'll just break this down a little bit. I already talked about the proceeds and In the beginning of this memo, I discussed how the expenditures for the cable were paid and some of the earlier ones, which came out of the self-insured risk fund. And so the table down there really is what we anticipate that the project total is going to be. And of that, you can see that we did have we did come in over under the overall budget, which included, you know, significant contingency. We did utilize part of that contingency, had to do with the days of MOB DMOB, influenced that a little bit. And we also had some metals adjustments that were part of the initial contract as well. But probably at the end of the day, folks are probably most interested in what's the difference between the total expenditures for the completed project compared to for what we bonded for at $13.37 million. And if you break down If you go below the blue line, then you'll see this depicts replenishing the self-insured risk fund for the monies that we removed out of it. And then that leaves an essentially $823,160 in excess funds that we bonded for. And we discussed this earlier with the board about bonding for the full amount that included the contingency, and we only used a small portion of that. So overall, super successful. And if you guys recall, we also, you know, we had negotiated this price down almost $2.5 million from the original. And part of that was that SEPA absorbed part of the risk for the MOB and DMOB times and the time to execute on the project and those elements. So we negotiated down $2.5 million. We ended up having to pay a little extra for an extra day there for the job. And so we really came out very, very well on the overall financials of the project. And if some of you may recall, when you do take out a bond, those funds are required to be used on the project that is intended for, or for a subsequent capital project. So this table here also shows the remaining balance of the, we'll call it the construction fund, after all the payments are made, that money would be transferred over to the dedicated R&R fund. And I'll pause here briefly, and actually I'll ask Robert to just add maybe a little bit more flavor to the milestone schedule, the payments, and how all that blended in, and then happy to field any questions on specific items.
I just reiterating kind of what Trey said is initially we had $2.5 million negotiation, and we took the risk. Basically, we understood Alaskan weather better than Japan did. And so we took the risk on delays. $258,000 a day was the cost of any delays or any surprises in the field. And so we did enough due diligence in the beginning of this project with our diving, with our ROVs, with our studies that we did of the bottom and how the sticking straight looks underneath the water, that we felt the risk was well taken. And so the $2.5 million turned into, with the $258,000 additional day, turned into $2.2 million in savings. And so that's kind of really the big takeaway on this project is, there was other contractors out there as well. And it could have gone either way. It could have gone, bad, but with the due diligence of the SEPA team, especially and our consultants, they did a great job. We were able to come in and save the agency quite a bit of money, which didn't have to be bonded for.
Thank you, Robert.
So Robert, you want to roll down to that next page there? I just want to point out one item, unless you had some other things you're angling on there. Where's page 32? Am I not seeing something? Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. It was just a little bit lower than that. There you go. Sorry. So on the milestone 9 and 10 narrative there, I just wanted to point out that 285 there, the 8 and 5 are transposed. It should reflect the 258 that's up above in the table there. Just wanted to point that out in case somebody is wondering why that was different than depicted above. So anyway, I guess we'll pause there and answer any questions you guys have.
So Trey, I know that we are waiting, to hear back from the insurance company on whether they were going to make any payments in regards to the failure of that. As we saw in the photographs that you guys supplied, there was a catastrophic failure there. I don't, in my opinion, look at it as, something that happened over a long period of time. And so with that, if we get a payment from the insurance company, how do we handle those monies in regards to the funds when they come back to us?
So first of all, I'll let Kay comment on when that money comes in, what is it considered as far as on the books, and then I'll comment on how we would potentially handle it.
So that would just be considered other income, the insurance itself. So it doesn't apply back to this project funding or any of the costs. It's simply additional income that we receive. So we can do whatever we want to with it, basically. Anyway, it's just income. It's doesn't offset the cost of the project or anything like that.
So with that, I'll just build on that a little bit. Thank you, Kay. So the board will have a decision once we figure out how much they're going to give it us an adjustment on there. And just to bring everybody up to date, the cables have been transferred to New Jersey to a lab there, and we're awaiting. They're going to do some non-destructive testing on it, and then they'll determine whether they want to, they've seen enough and they're ready to make a decision, or if they want to move into some type of destructive testing. If they go to destructive testing, or if their findings are contrary to what we believe, then we'll send our cable expert down there to witness any other testing or redo testing that they've performed. And then hopefully we can come to terms on the test results, and then whatever they determine is the adjustment that'll be made. So, with regard to those proceeds, just to remind folks, you know, we had a $5 million policy. We had a $250,000 retention, or you could consider that a deductible. So we have potentially $4.75 million coming that could, at the max, come back into CEPA's through additional income. So one thing, and we've talked about this briefly before, is one potential use for that money would be to buy the spare cable, which would be a good investment toward the future to get the maximum benefit out of the rest of the existing cable. So that's one use. It could be applied to capital projects. The board's talked about, you know, the need to potentially increase funding for larger capital projects. So there's a number of uses there. And once we get the information back from the insurance company, I'll write up a summary of options and considerations for the board. And I suspect we'll have a longer conversation about that.
That sounds good, Trey. I know that we are looking at this storing a cable in Southeast to be able to do that. And that's just about a perfect match for the money if it comes as we hope it does. But we also have future projects such as the building here in Ketchikan, get out and renting, get our warehousing in one spot, and other things like that that we have to yet to discuss. And it may be a portion of that would be utilized for some of that construction. So I appreciate that, and I'm looking forward to a longer discussion in regards to capital projects as we move forward. So thank you.
Certainly. Any other questions on that particular topic?
Mr. Chair, we come into the end of the conversation for the budget here, or will we have an opportunity to comment before vote?
You can comment on now. We do have a motion on the table to accept those, so it's appropriate. Okay.
So wanted to say good job looking forward on the staff with regard to the cable. I'll have some additional questions with regard to that during comments. about what we might want to see on the December agenda for cable spare. And then obviously we can also follow up offline. And just as a closing comment with regard to financials and my questions with regard to true up and how they apply to the financials, I appreciate the attorney's comments. My comments in no way are to state that there's something inappropriate or not shown in, or shown inappropriately. I know that in years past, it has been there's been some conflict with regard to that topic amongst members. My intention is not to create any conflict. My intention is only to bring to the fact that there is a revenue there that has been available to us in the past and will be available to us here this year. And I just didn't see a reflection of that or acknowledging that. So that's all.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you. Anybody else?
Mr. Chair, just if I'll go ahead and just, if it's okay, close out on the disbursement, just a quick narrative on it. And then I see Joy Mariner and Travis Werba have joined us too. So they're on standby.
All right.
If that's okay.
That would be perfect.
Okay. So just moving on real quickly here into the disbursements. As I previously mentioned, you know, we had over $7 million in disbursements and we're anticipating another rather large chunk here over the next 30 days. So, that's a reflection of how much work's getting done and we've got multiple projects we've been actively working on. And so these are pretty self-explanatory. The larger items we usually try to annotate for the board's benefit, and happy to answer any questions that might be on the disbursements.
Are there any other comments or questions in regard to disbursements at this time? Hearing, seeing none, we have a motion on the floor. Sharon, would you please call the roll?
I will. Sievertson?
Yes.
Skillings?
Yes.
Hagerman? Mr. Hagerman, you're on mute.
Sorry about that. Yes.
No problem. Prysanka?
Yes.
Bynum?
Yes.
Thank you.
So do we have a motion to discuss before we move on with the report of the audit? Yes. Do I have a motion, please?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
I move to accept the audited financial statements of the Southeast Alaska Power Agency for the year ended December 31st, 2020, as presented at the September 9th, 2021 board meeting.
Second.
It has been moved and seconded. Trey, we have Joy online, so would you go ahead and proceed?
Sure. So Joy, the floor is yours. I don't think you need any introduction, but Joy is the assurance partner for SEPA's auditing for BDO, and also has Travis on as well, who was actively involved in the audit. And so I appreciate you guys calling in and taking the time to address SEPA's board today, and I'll turn the floor over to you.
Great. Well, thank you, Trey, and hello, everyone. I'm Joy Mariner. So for those of you I don't know yet, I look forward to presenting with Travis the results of the audit for the 2020 financial statements. I serve as the audit partner at BDO here in Anchorage. And then Travis Werba is the audit. He's actually experienced audit manager at this point. He's been on your engagement for quite a few years. And I'm going to turn over the floor to Travis to walk through the audit wrap-up and the financial statements themselves at a very high level for you. These are the financials are finally a full year. So you had a change in your fiscal year end in 2019. So we did a kind of 2019 June 30, 2019, at December 31, 2019. And then now we're finally at a full year's worth of financial statement information, as the, for this year's audit. I'll just kind of at a very high level let you know that as usual, your team did an excellent job. We don't have any, you know, significant concerns to communicate, but there are some required communications for you as the board that we want to go through. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Travis. And if it's easiest, I can share my screen. I don't know if you guys have me as a presenter or not, but whatever you prefer. Otherwise, I think we'll start with the audit wrap-up.
Yeah. Thank you, Joy. Yeah, the first thing I'm going to go through is the audit wrap-up. Does everyone have a copy of that? Or
so Travis, we have it up on screen now, so if you can walk through it, that'd be great.
Okay. That sounds... There we go. All right. So first things first. So this is just, as Joy mentioned, part of our professional, the professional standards require us to communicate with you, kind of at the beginning of the audit, what our plan is, which was distributed to Kay and Trey. And then at the end of the audit, we'd like to, communicate with the board what is, if there's any significant findings, issues, or just the overall results of the audit. So if we turn to page three, here it kind of states that we have completed our audit for the year ended December 31st, 2020. Our audit was performed in accordance with the GAS or the governmental auditing standards. So we are issuing a the purpose of our audit is to gain reasonable assurance, not absolute assurance over the financial statements. So I like to point this out just so we're both, everyone knows what we're required to do here. We can, it's not feasible for us to dig into every last detail of the balance sheet and income statement. We just, we set a scope and from there, gain assurance over that. We are issuing a unmodified opinion over the financial statements this year, which is the highest level of assurance that we can give. And then if you look at the last bullet point there, I'd just like to reiterate or echo what Joy had said about management's cooperation, during the engagement. It's always been good ever since I've been on the audit. Any requests that we have, they always fulfill, and it's just great working with a team like that. On the next page, this goes over kind of some areas in the audit that are higher risk, such as unusual transactions or significant estimates. It was a pretty quiet year for SEPA as far as these type of transactions. There wasn't any significant estimates. SEPA does have some estimates such as the potential impairment of assets or obsolete inventory, which was not the case this year. There is an estimate in depreciation as far as determining what the useful life of the asset is. This isn't considered a significant estimate just due to management doesn't. It's just on industry standard, and there's not a lot of management judgment in that. There was no change in how these numbers were calculated this year either. It's been the same year over year. And then the next, as far as corrected and uncorrected misstatements this year, there was no none identified that were more than clearly trivial, which is quite an accomplishment, especially when you guys did a IT conversion or system conversion this year, as far as switching systems and making sure balances rolled forward and account structures are set up properly. There's a lot of work that goes into that, so good job on Kay and Trey's part, making sure that went smoothly. So internal controls over reporting. As part of our audit, we look at the SEPA's internal controls and make sure they're operating effectively and that there are controls in place. We don't express an opinion over this, but it is something we look at to help design our audit procedures due to if there's not controls in place, it could be a higher risk area. The little chart below kind of breaks down what each of these, the severity of the deficiency. There's 6 deficiency, which is the lowest level of deficiency we can find, and then significant deficiency is kind of the in between, and then material weakness is something that we would that would raise more concern than the other two. The one thing we did identify was there's no inventory count being performed at year end, so that is something that we've reported on in the past, and it's not as big of an issue with a client that's not using their inventory as sales and generating revenue from it. This is more of the inventory on hand for SEPA is more of repairs and maintenance type stuff that they use as at their remote locations.
Right. So just if I can comment on that. So that's really almost like a business advice suggestion, although accounting standards do recommend you perform inventories at least every 2 years, especially if they were grant funded. And to some degree, your systems have been grant funded in the past, not entirely. But I will just say that, you know, there's not a whole lot of risk. This inventory is going to walk away. Somebody's going to steal it. You know, it's not like you're sitting on a warehouse full of iPads. And for the most part, it's not also not going to go obsolete. Most of this inventory is associated with a turbine or with a system that's in place, so that you're keeping it for some longer term period of time. But it is important still to do an inventory periodically. It gets a little bit messy sometimes with, you know, what's construction material, what's, especially if you're working on a construction project. So it's something we bring up and we've talked about with your team. I'm not elevating it to a level that I think could cause a significant issue with your financial statements. But, you know, especially if you move forward with being an RUS borrower, maybe you have that, or if you start having more oversight from other angles, it's something you want to get into place.
Okay. And then on the next page, just kind of some overall, comments on this. The first bullet point, there was no changes to our audit strategy that we proposed in our planning doc to Trey and Kay, which is great news. Normally, we'll change our audit plan if we come into find issues or if there's disagreements with management or something to that extent. So that's always good news when there's nothing, no changes there. We did not require any management experts on the third one down. So this, everything was done in-house by the Anchorage office, and there was no special knowledge needed. No significant issues arised from related parties or whatnot. In the footnotes of the financials this year, you will see that the three cities are disclosed as related parties in the financial statement, but we received confirms and confirmed the balance, and there was no issues. And that disagreements with management or significant difficulties encountered during the audit. Once again, Kay and Trey have always been great to work with. So no issues on that end. And at this time, then, I think that any questions on the wrap-up doc, I'll pause for a minute.
Thank you, Travis. Is there any questions on the wrap-up documents at this particular point in time?
I will just comment that we did actually have an inventory this spring early in the year. So we're going to try to do that on an annual basis now, but got it done once.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kate. And I guess this is a question. Did we use our MapCom system for a lot of the inventory at the plants?
We have not.
Okay.
We've discussed trying to tie those two things together. they're still doing a lot of work on MAPCON, and I think that that's probably our long-term goal.
Thank you.
I'll also add that we don't have that many items inventoried. We have a very limited inventory, so it's easier to keep it simple than to try to integrate it into a more complicated system that's in transition.
Yeah, I think you're right, Trey, but I think the other factor is that these are remote sites, so there's certain inventory that's probably considered critical inventory, and those are the ones I'm more concerned about.
That's part of our overall goal with regard to inventories is identifying critical spares in trying to get those ordered and in place.
Thank you.
But one thing I'll just, if I may, contribute a little to that conversation. One thing to watch out for is if you're buying critical spares or inventory that's associated with a turbine that's a very specific model or a specific kind, and it wouldn't be used once that's out of service, you may consider building in an obsolescence reserve. And the reason for doing that is, you know, if you're, say, depreciating that turbine,